Hello and welcome. Luke Burridge is being listened to and the Science Fiction Book Review podcast is being played. This is some show where some books are reviewed, but not on some set schedule, only when someone has gotten round to it. Yes, this is an episode where, of course, some novel by Tobias S. Buckell is going to get gotten reviewed. Okay, enough of that. As I start the podcast, I always start with a bit of news. So here's some important news. I've been on a cruise ship for the last 2 weeks, and I've not been reading much, except for this book that I'm going to talk to you about today, because I have been writing quite a bit. So if you are interested on reading the follow-up novel to both Combat and Minding Tomorrow, which are the two previous novels that I've released, which are sort of set in the same world, they're not a series. One isn't in front of the other. You don't have to read Minding Tomorrow first and then Combat, or Combat first and then Mining Tomorrow, but you need to have read them both before you read the third in this weird series triangle of novels. I don't really have any title for it yet, a working title of Broken Glass, but I think that kind of is a little bit of a spoiler, but then Combat is a spoiler for what that book's about, and Mining Tomorrow is a bit of a spoiler about what that book is about. But anyway, if you read both Combat and Mining Tomorrow, you can read this book soon. And if you want to read it straight away, I actually need some people to give me some feedback and help a little bit with the editing process. You know, just drop me a line, do anything you want, like that. So email me, luke@juggler.net. If you're interested, I already have two readers lined up to read this final one, but I think that a lot of people have been waiting to find out what the fuck was going on in Minding Tomorrow and what the fuck is going on in Combat. There's lots of questions still need to be answered there, and this book pretty much answers all of them. So that's one bit of news. Also, I've been uploading quite a lot of stuff to my blog recently. I've scheduled a post, so one post full of photos or with a few photos in it should go out every other day, and then on the day in between those every other day, I've been scheduling lots of bits of writing about lots of different things. Again, I might as well keep it vague, as that's what this episode might be a little bit about. So subscribe to my blog. I've even been putting some reviews up there as well. I think a review that's coming up is going to be a review of a fan edit of Star Wars, or two different fan edits of two different Star Wars movies, The Phantom Edit and A New Hope Revisited. Lots of people say, hey, you should review movies, but I never really have that much to say about movies. But if you want to check out a movie review, you should be able to find it on my blog if you just search for fan edits. And talking of fan edits, I might address that point later on in this episode. Anyway, you can find my blog at lukeburridge.com and click on blog, or lukeburridge.com/blog. So now, enough of news and feedback and all that kind of stuff. I'll get onto some feedback later, maybe, depends how long this episode goes. But let's get on to this episode. I'm going to be reviewing Arctic Rising by Tobias S. Buckell. And I've read some books of his in the past. There was one book which was called The Alchemist and the Executionist, which was really, really good secondary world fantasy short. It's quite a short novel, actually two novellas put together, and it was released as an Audible exclusive. They wrote it for Audible, so it was, I listened to it as an audiobook. Paolo Bacigalupi and Tobias S. Buckell, yeah, The Alchemist and the Executionist, I'm reading this here, episode 102, if you want to listen to that. I gave it 4.5 stars, so that's very, very high rated. So lots of good stuff going on in there. Another full novel by Tobias S. Buckell that I read was called Crystal Rain, and let me check here, episode number 53, I gave that 2 stars. It started promising, interesting characters, nice mystery, but really, really flawed action and flawed story. I mean, so much to like, but then just the writing, really let down by the writing. All of his other novels have been set in that same sequence. Crystal Rain, I know there's one called Ragamuffin, Sly Mongoose, that kind of thing. And after reading Crystal Rain, I thought, well, it was all right. And I always like to give an author another chance. But sometimes if the world that the book is set in doesn't really grab me in the way that I want it to, I will just skip to another series or read another book. So, but this is the first of his novels, which is outside of any series or outside of I'd have to check it out. So, and also the reason why I want to give Tobias another chance with his novel after giving his first full novel just two star, debut novel two stars is because I really enjoy his blog. It'll often happen where I'll read a novel and enjoy it so much that I think, well, what does the, you know, what's on the author's website? And if they have a blog there, sometimes I'll subscribe just for a while, just to sort of see what kind of tone it is there. And actually, Tobias Bekele's blog is one of my favorite blogs. He doesn't post that much about fiction. I mean, he does a bit, but because he's always researching stuff for his science fiction, he posts loads and loads and loads of future technology ideas and current technology and this and that. And because he does that, and a few other blogs that I subscribe to do similar things, it means I don't have to keep up with blogs like Boing Boing and actually like New Scientist and all these new kind of science stuff. There's, you know, one podcast that I listen to which talks about latest science things and technology, and then Tobias's blog, one or two other little things like that. Anyway, because I was subscribed to his blog, he said, hey, if anyone wants an ARC, which is an advanced reader copy of my new novel, which is coming out soon, send me an email. And I never ask for advanced reader copies of any novels. And if I get sent them, sometimes I get sent ebooks of those kind of things. And if publishers or authors, they say, hey, can we send you a book to review so you can review it for your podcast? I generally just say no. But I always say, look, I don't see this, but on the podcast, I say to this, any author, if you're an author or a publisher or a publicist for an author who I've reviewed in the past and given at least 3.5 stars to, preferably 4 stars to, you can send me a book and I'll probably read it. If not, just don't bother. I'm not going to read any new authors and I'm not going to read any established authors, which I don't already really like, just because someone sends me a free book. I'm totally happy with reading stuff. Anyway, but this time I thought, well, Tobias Bekele, I've been reading his blog for a few years now, probably a few years, and I've sort of, as he's been developing the ideas for this book and talking about the setting of this book, I thought, well, I actually want to read what he's been putting all that work into and what he's been putting all that research into, so I thought I'd give it a go. Often when people send me an ebook, a publisher will send me an ebook, even if I don't ask for it, they just send it anyway. It'll often come as a PDF file, which are a real pain to read. You know, they're difficult to. I mean, sometimes you can search through them, but I do all my ebook reading on an iPhone, and normally PDF files are formatted to be able to read like an A4 bit of paper, and the text is just way too small on an iPhone. But Tobias, or his assistant Emily, sent it as an RTF file, just a rich text file, so I could just open it and format it any way I wanted and load it onto my iPhone in a really easy thing. And within, you know, minutes, I was reading the first chapter, which is way easier than in most, you know, PDF formats that most advanced reader copies seem to come in. And I read a bit, and then I read a bit more, and I read a lot longer than I was expecting just to sort of read a sample, and sort of got a bit captivated by the novel. And then because it's not a particularly long novel, I stayed up the whole night and read the whole thing, probably over the course of around about 6 hours, maybe seven or eight hours in total of reading this. So I'm not sure how long it is, but I'm guessing probably around about 250 pages. Actually, I can just open it in this text thing, and it says 79,126 words. Or 439,326 characters. That's the really cool stuff. And because it's a text file, not only can I look exactly how many words it is, I could actually make lots of notes as I was going through it, which may make this review a little bit longer. Anyway, I'm going to break this review into two parts, because that's kind of how I broke my brain into two parts as I was reading this book. First, I'm going to talk about the world and the story and all the stuff that I normally talk about in a normal review. And then the last section of this review, I'll concentrate on the writing. And those who know Tobias Espekel's writing will probably understand what I mean by that. So anyway, Arctic Rising. Let's get into this. The world that it is set in. I just want to say this right off the bat. This is really important. What this book does so well let me put it this way. What Red Mars by Kin Stanley Robinson and that whole series did for the future of Mars and that planet, Arctic Rising does for the future of the top of this planet. And also kind of what Antarctica did for me with Antarctica, and that's also by Kin Stanley Robinson. It sets out of a description of the future of this region, Mars, Antarctica, the Arctic Circle, all stuff like that, which is so well thought out and so logical that as I was reading it, I was just thinking, oh yeah, of course, oh yeah, of course, oh right, now I see, oh yeah, now I understand it. Like now when I think of Mars and I think about the future of Mars, I always think about the future as set out in Red Mars. And any time I'm reading another science fiction book, for example, spoiler here, when I was reading Terminal World by Alistair Reynolds, which is, spoiler, set on Mars, even though it's never mentioned in the book, all the time I was thinking, it's like, oh yeah, I know that because of this that I read in Red Mars. Oh, I know that idea because I read it in Red Mars. I know that because I read it in Red Mars. And I think that's what Arctic Rising is going to give me every time now that I think about the future of the Arctic and about, of course, this is set 50 years in the future, 40 years in the future, something like that. It's always going to bring me back every time I think, oh, the ice caps are melting. Oh, the polar bears are running out of ice. Oh, there's glaciers are melting and more land is being exposed underneath them. The go-to reference in my brain from now on, I think, is going to be Arctic Rising, just because, well, maybe not just because, but mainly because I've never read another novel set in the Arctic Circle before, when the ice caps have melted. Normally, in a science fiction book set in the future, the ice caps are melting. Oh, the sea levels are rising and stuff like that. But it's just a one-word thing which says, hey, now you're in the future because there's no ice on the Arctic Circle, above the Arctic Circle anymore. There's no ice in the summer at the North Pole. And things like that. So that's what we have here. It's set in the future. The Northwest Passage is opened. The ice caps have shrunk down to nothing, and we're left with a slightly warmer Arctic Circle. I say slightly warmer because it's only just about warm enough so it doesn't freeze up anymore. And I've been on ships to these places. A few years ago, I was on a cruise ship with an ice-hardened hull, and we sailed all the way up right to the edge and even slightly into the Arctic pack ice. I got to within about 600 miles off the North Pole, and I've visited Greenland before, and I visited Spitsbergen in Svalbard, which is way, 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 way north off the north tip of Norway. You go to Norway and then sail 4 or 5 days north, and you get to almost to the North Pole and things like that. Earlier last year, in May last year, I was in Norway, and I was driving alongside the fjord, and the taxi driver was saying, oh yeah, the fjord here, it iced up, and the reason why it all iced up and it iced up for so long was because it was too warm. And what happens is things like this, I mean, this is why it's always really confusing when people are talking about global warming. There was more ice in the fjord because it didn't snow so much, it actually rained too much, and the rain washed away all the snow that had fallen before, flooded into the fjord, the salinity in the fjord dropped, which then meant that the water could freeze at a higher temperature, and even though the temperature hadn't got down as low as it normally did, it got down low enough that the water could freeze, so the fjord was iced up for ages and ages and ages, and they couldn't get any icebreakers in there, because it's, you know, there's not enough space for any of the ice to go, and they're all blocked up, and the ferries weren't working, and all the roads are closed off, and things like that. So it's this kind of thing which I really like, and that's what Arctic Rising brings out. I've been to these places, I've been to high Arctic, you know, parts, you know, well above the Arctic Circle in the summer. I've seen the midnight sun in Norway, and this really does bring it all to life. In fact, I think in a way he could have even talked about the midnight sun even more, because it seems to be set over the summer and it's always light, and I think that could, you know, he could have brought that out more. But there's lots and lots of really good stuff in here, and like I say, very logically thought out, well planned and well set out. What am I saying here? Well, I've got some notes here. Some things that I really liked, really loved about this is that you got these, of course, the greenhouses growing food in the summer, which goes, oh, of course, I've been to Iceland. And when I was in Iceland, they said Iceland is one of the largest banana production companies outside of the tropics, because they've got in the summer, they've got 24-hour sunlight. It's great for growing plants. And of course, Iceland has got the geothermal power to heat up its greenhouse and stuff like that. And of course, he's talking about the new islands that pop out from under the ice and then disappear as the sea levels rise. And also, Greenland is now like this superpower, even though there's not very many people there. They sort of bring in these guest workers and say, okay, you can work down our mines because we've got lots of fuel here and we've got lots of raw materials and stuff like that. So Greenland becomes a superpower, which is quite fun. And then one of the main things that I really like about it is that there's Thule. And Thule is the, of course, the mystical Northland. But now that is the name given to the North Pole, because you can actually sail all the way up to the North Pole And in the North Pole, all the ice is melting so much, but what they've done is they're artificially freezing the North Pole to make it into a mid-ocean port and a place to save the polar bears, I guess that's what you could say, and things like that. So that, yeah, artificially keeping the North Pole frozen for tourists and polar bears and industry, and that kind of thing is really, really interesting. Now, this is a slight, some of these are slight spoilers, but not really, because as soon as they mention Thule, I'm just thinking, well, of course, the action has to end up in Thule. It sounds so awesome that they're keeping the North Pole, and I'm not giving it too much away when I say, yeah, that is where all the action accumulates at the end of the book, so we get there. And there are quite a few silly but fun and interesting things that talk about, for example, on Thule are different domains, and in each domain is like this little nation that has been set up, and there's experimental politics going on there, which reminded me a lot of any Kim Stanley Robinson novel that I've read, you know, especially Antarctica and the Red, Green, Blue Mars series. It's all talking about politics, this, and these people are trying this kind of little government, and it's like this is an anarchy, this is a dictatorship, this is something else, this is something else, you know, really good stuff there. So the world of this book and all the action that goes on in it that explores the world is the one of the main strengths of the book, and it really stood out for me. Like I say, there's not many books that I will say this will now become the reference point for an entire geographical region, but that's what this probably will be for me now, because, you know, and even though I've been to those places, and I mentioned this before in my review of Antarctica, I'd not been to Antarctica when I read Antarctica for the first time, and then when I got to Antarctica, it made me look at Antarctica in a new way that I hadn't before, just because I'd learned so much about it through a novel. I think this novel would do that for the other end of the world. So moving on to the plot, so we have Annika, and Annika is she is a pilot on an airship, and she patrols the Baffin Bay, I think it is, for the UN Arctic Preservation Agency. Can't remember that. I'm just making these names up here. But anyway, she does some stuff, and she regulates, makes sure nobody is going to dump stuff into the sea, radioactive waste into the sea. And she spots a ship with some kind of radioactive cargo on it, and is like, oh, they're going to dump this radioactive waste onto the sea. Let's go down there in our little airship, in our little blimp, and try and get it out, get them to stop. And as she flies down there, the airship gets shot and gets shot down, and then she gets rescued, and she wants to know, hey, if they were just dumping radioactive waste, why did they shoot me? She wants to know what was on the ship, who is behind it, and immediately, right at the beginning of the book, conspiracy! And because there was a conspiracy, she gets chased around a lot, and at the same time, she's trying to get to the bottom of this conspiracy, so she is doing chasing and chasing after information and after people all the way around the Arctic Circle, and of course, we get to see lots of places! And that's what the book I really want, because there's lots of places to see, so really what we want to do is travel around these different places, travel around the Arctic Circle, go on a big tour, that's what we want. And that's what we get. And I really enjoyed it. And in that way, the novel, up until the very, very last part of the book, up until maybe the last quarter or the last fifth of the book, works perfectly. We start off in Baffin Bay, we go over here, we go there, we go here, we go there, go to Greenland, we go to an oil rig, we go to the other, and we get to the North Pole, and of course that must be where the action ends. And we get there, and the conspiracy is getting bigger and bigger and bigger, and the stakes are rising higher and higher and higher, and then suddenly it's all explained, and everything's all explained, and they reach the North Pole. I'm like, great. And then, for some reason, the last part of the novel, bizarre action sequence happens. I'm being passive in a way. A bizarre action sequence happens, and it's not needed. And I was actually quite sad that it happened, because we know all the information, we know what happens. You know, we've got to the bottom of everything. They've reached the North Pole. What else needs to do? But then suddenly someone does something stupid, and I groan. I was like, oh, really? And because I was wondering, hey, we've got to the North Pole. We know all the secrets. We know everything's what's going to happen. They've saved the day, and there was still, like, you know, according to my my iPhone screen e-reader thing, it says there's still 40 pages left out of like 700 pages. Like, what's going to happen now in these last 40 pages? Yeah, I say, someone does something really stupid, and then I was just like, oh, It's going to now be lots of people shooting and doing stuff, trying to fix stupid problem that only rose due to someone being stupid. And it's a real pity, because everything, or at least most things, up until that point, really made sense. A few little plot holes, I think, but most things made sense, and then it just stupid stuff happened at the end. I was like, don't do the stupid stuff. It was almost as bad. No, it's nowhere near as bad as the stupid end of Crystal Rain, which, spoiler alert, someone is searching for a spaceship, and they get the spaceship, and what do? They use it as a troop transporter? What the fuck? Do something better with it. And then at the end of this, I'm just like, you're getting there, and they're going, I was like, oh, don't do stupid stuff like that. Anyway, up until then, really, really strong plot. Really, really strong setting. Quite strong plot. Pretty strong plot. Very strong setting. Moving on to the characters. We spend every moment of this novel with Annika. She is our main protagonist, viewpoint character, of course. Which means, of course, at some points, she is in a room with important people for no other reason except because they know something and they have to tell someone. She would never find out about that important thing unless she was there, because she's not important enough to be told. She's just an airship pilot. In some cases, it's a little bit clunky, but because she's a pilot and she's from a bad neighborhood, she's a bit of a badass. She's good at the badassery. Badass stuff happens to other people, and then she's there. She grew up in a rough city and in a rough country, and she's no problems letting her more violent side out. You know, if she's in a scrape, if she's in danger, she is gonna kick ass. And I really quite liked her, and spending time with her, because, you know, her, well, just she's just interesting. I mean, she's nice, I guess, nice, but also that hard edge makes her interesting. Her motivations at some point seem a bit weird, but, you know, she's paranoid, there's a conspiracy, and that'll make you do stupid things. If you don't know all the information, you'll do some stupid stuff and make some bad decisions. And sometimes those bad decisions, well, not so much bad decisions, but, like, she makes choices to do things which might not be bad, but I'm thinking, that's not really your job. And other people are saying, oh, this isn't really your job. Like, at the beginning of the novel, she gets a choice. Keep going into danger, or back out while you're safe. And pretty much someone actually asked her that. Go into danger, or back out while you're safe. And I, personally, would have backed out, because I am a coward, or I am intelligent. It depends which way you want to look at it. You know, I said this to Paula, my previous girlfriend. You know, when I met her, we were talking about, I can't remember what we were talking about, watching a movie, and someone said, oh, I love you so much, I'd die for you. And I actually decided at that moment, I would never love anyone so much that, you know, I think this is what I said to Paula. I said, I love you so much that I wouldn't die for you, and I wouldn't kill for you. No, I love you so much that I'll never get us into a situation where one of us has to kill for, or either die for, the other person. I think at the time I said it in a much more poetic way, but I just love the idea. It's like, I love you so much that I would run away from danger with you as fast as possible rather than anything like that. Or run away from danger to be with you. Fuck the other things. Fuck the end of the world. Get away from them. No. I'll probably be okay if I just leave it and let the professionals going out. I guess in storytelling, this is called the call to action. And normally, the formula is that it happens twice. The first time the protagonist, you know, it's call to action, will you do this? And they back down, but then the stakes are raised. And then the second time, will you have this? It's like they haven't got a choice, because suddenly it's all more important that they have to take up the call. Annika, on the other hand, she's just like, okay, the first time it comes up, it's just like, call to action, will you do this? She's like, fuck yeah, I'm trained with all the punchy, kicky, shooty skills, that's all I need, let's go, woo! So that's what I like about her, that she gets up and does stuff, even though I'd be like, no, I'm going about the other way around. I'm going the other way. Most of the other characters sort of just hang out, except for one character called Rue. He just turns up partway through the novel, and I was like, oh, here's another character. But suddenly we spent a little bit more time with him without action happening. and then you realize, oh, he's going to be a main character. And again, and of course, when he turns up, you know he's kind of going to be a main character, because he's from the Caribbean. Just like Tobias Espekel is from the Caribbean, so this is obviously sort of like his, hey, this is going to be my, I would say, token Caribbean character, or Caribbean character, depends where you're from, because, you know, I would say him being a token is racist. Well, me saying it's token is racist, because it's not that. He's a badass. Rue is another badass, because he is a spy from the United Caribbean Spy Agency. And me, again, my total racist side coming out, finds this really, really funny that there's a Caribbean spy agency, because my only interaction in the Caribbean is, you know, snorkeling and hanging out in hammocks and laying on beaches and eating food and drinking lots and jumping into waterfalls and and doing all that kind of stuff. I mean, as far as I know, you know, because I work on cruise ships, so I'm going all the way around the world all the time. So when I get to the Caribbean, I'm just, you know, just hanging out. It's great. Like, the only thing that I know that the Caribbean actually exports, they don't export anything except, you know, food and stuff like that, and cricket. I guess they export cricket players, and then it's like, oh, Caribbean Spy Agency. But it makes sense. It makes sense because, and I'll get to this later on in the review as well, it's like, you know, Rue has his, he has the skills of sailing around the islands in the sailing boat and keeping track of stuff and things. He's like, yeah. And now, once all the ice is gone, I've got the same skills that I need. Sail around all these different islands, do this intelligence work. This is what I do. It's what I'm good for. So I've been trained. I was like, yeah, of course. The people from the tropical island kind of nations where everything is seafaring, of course, they will be the ones who are more suited to the Arctic once the ice is gone. Probably. There is another character who is needed for the plot, but it doesn't really have as much life as I would like. She's got a presence in the plot because she's needed for plot mechanics in a way. Let me put it that way, and motivations and things. But she, like I say, I wish there was just a little bit more to her. Violet is the owner of a greenhouse, a nightclub set in a greenhouse, and. But that's really all you know. I mean, you know other stuff about her, but you don't really get to know her. You know about her, but you don't know her. Let me put it that way. She's one of those characters that kind of tags along in a party, in a party of adventurers, and contributes so little that you kind of forget she's there after a few after a few paragraphs or a few chapters, and suddenly she pops up and says something. It's like, oh yeah, Violet's still around. Oh, like that. Not a major flaw in the novel, but like I would have liked her to be a little bit more. What's my other note here? Oh yeah, I put the note, okay. Now, the note, okay, here in my notes is just to remind me that there is another thing about this novel which I bet would come up probably in the first or second line of most reviews that you're going to read about this novel. It'll say something like this, this is not the blurb on the back of the book, but this is how, you know, this is how the review will set off, like, when someone writes a review, it'll be like, set in the Arctic Circle after all the ice has melted, an adventure, conspiracy, action, tale, blah, blah, blah. Second line, I'm sure, will contain Annika, our protagonist, is female! And then they'll be like, oh, holy shit, the female character! Ah, but there's more to that. In the same sentence of the same review, it'll say, she is a black female! They're like, holy shit, a non-Caucasian protagonist! And then it gets even better. In the same sentence of that same review, there'll be, like, this fact that she is also a lesbian. And I'm thinking, holy shit, homosexual black female lead character? What's going on here? Tobias Bekele, how dare you write from the point of view when you are a straight, white, American male, although I guess he's not white, he's mixed race, I guess, but he's straight and white and lives in America, how dare you put, you know, I mean, I don't really care about this kind of stuff, because, I mean, but some people go, oh, why are you doing like this? Is it a bit like, is it tokenism to have a black homosexual African female lead character, or is it just someone going, oh, this will make an interesting thematic point, which I think it is, but I think it does it really well, because, although, to be honest, the mindset of gay females from Nigeria, not really my area of expertise, but I like the fact that she learned her badass skills in Nigeria. Again, like, Rue learned his sailing and other skills trying to protect the islands, and, you know, he's all going about, you know, is, oh, down in the Caribbean, we're affected by sea level rises more than everyone else, that's why I'm up here, it makes a lot big difference for me. And, you know, she learned to fly in Nigeria across the kind of bush territories, and was doing this, and she learned how to shoot and fly planes and all that kind of stuff, but in more of like a Wild West frontier territory in Africa. But now the Arctic Circle is that same frontier Wild West Circle, Arctic Circle West, North, Wild Wild North frontier territory. I totally lost control of that sentence halfway through. Anyway, white guy from the USA who is a pilot probably wouldn't, I mean, maybe he would have the skills, but then the skills would have to be, okay, where are you going to learn to fly and shoot? Well, you'd be in the military. But this book wouldn't work if the main character was from the military. It works that she has a past which is not in the military, but she can kick ass because she comes from a bad neighborhood. She can fly around in a frontier kind of world like she did around the different bush in the outback. Well, bush in the outback of Africa. What am I trying to say? In, you know, the sub-Saharan Africa. No, is Nigeria sub-Saharan? I guess, whatever. Anyway, it's all in that part. That it made sense to me, you know. Even people who had grown or were born in the Arctic Circle probably wouldn't have had the skills. You know, the Inuits or the Canadian First Nation people probably wouldn't have had the skills that Annika would have needed to be there. So I actually really like that. So yeah, putting characters, black characters from the tropics into the Arctic is more than just a quirky, hey, I'm a Rasta man and I'm up here in the ice and the cold, like Cool Runnings, I guess. Why didn't I even think of that reference? It's not just Cool Runnings where you go, oh, Caribbean in ice with skates. It's something a lot more like that. It makes the Arctic feel like a wilderness, that it's home for anyone or a home for people with a certain set of skills and a certain mindset. And that she's female? Well, I actually quite like females kicking ass because it's better than guys, I guess. Because, you know, it's not that... I mean, it's sometimes hard to root for the big guy. The big guy's like, oh, I'm a big guy, and I'm up against a guy, and I'm going to kick the big guy. And it's like, yeah, but the woman is the underdog going up against a real threat. Not that I want to call the woman a dog when I say an underdog. I'm saying that she is, in many situations, is the, I wouldn't say the weaker, but the less physically able than some of the badass guys that she goes up against. And... beats the crap out of, well, not really, sometimes. Sometimes she gets beaten up, sometimes she can beat them up, but it makes that. Also, coming on to the point that she's gay, that she's a lesbian, kind of makes the story more relaxing, because so many times when you're reading a story with a female protagonist, every man who turns up, you're like, oh, is this going to be the love interest? Oh, fuck, it's going to, is it? No, oh, they're just going to, oh, they're going to play with it. And in here, don't have to worry about it. Sudden love triangles that suddenly pop up in other books, not really going to happen here. Not many other females in the book, less other gay females in the book, which suddenly makes that kind of, oh, it's going to be about finding someone. And it is about that, but it's just a lot less, like, it's, you know, it's like, I don't want her to do stupid things, or a guy to do stupid things with her. It sort of makes her strong in the end. Anyway, so black, gay, female lead actually makes the book a lot less annoying to read and thematically brings out a lot more about the environment than white, female, straight lead or white, male, straight lead protagonist character. Moving on to the science and technology, really liked a lot of this kind of stuff, and this is where I really see all the research that Tobias has been doing and posting on his blog. He's like, hey, check this out. Hey, check this out. Hey, check this out. Yeah, there's some power station here. There's this thing in the sky here. There's an airship here. Another airship here. Here's another. I think he quite likes airships. Anyway, lots of good stuff there as well. Thule, I really like, where they put the cables out and cryogenically freeze the sea to make extra land at the North Pole. Lots of really good tech. There's a really, really, really cool bit of technology that pops up later, but I don't want to spoil it. I kind of half guessed it near the beginning when you first get a glimpse at this technology, and I was like, oh, this is clever, I see what they're going to do. And I was right, but it was way... it was right, but then there was like another four or five factors to it, which were just way cooler than I thought it was going to be. But I don't want to spoil it. Anyway, I don't really want to talk too much about the technology, because like the setting, that's what you're reading the book about, and it's a lot of cool stuff in there. And of course, there's lots of stuff just about sailing and kayaking and all that kind of stuff. Like I said, the book is really about going around lots of different locations by as many different forms of transport as possible. Here and there, it's like a real planes, trains, and automobile, although no trains. I don't think there's any trains in the Arctic, but we do kind of tick off the list of cars and trucks and motorbikes and helicopters and planes and airships and jet skis and helicopters, did I say that already? And sailing boats and motorboats and nuclear boats and submarines and kayaks and, you know, I'm not kidding. It's like a Bond movie, you know. Every chase they Bond has to do, they go, okay, what hasn't he had a chase in here? How about a car? Done the car. How about an aeroplane? Done an aeroplane. How about a car that turns into an aeroplane? Put it in. How about a tank? Had a tank. How about a tank which turns into a submarine? Put it in. How about a... how about a skiing? Skiing's been done. How about parachutes? Parachutes been done. How about skis that turn into a parachute? It's not that bad, but we do get, like I say, the full planes, trains, automobiles kind of thing going on there. Now, normally at this point of the book, I would talk about the writing of the book, but I'm going to save that, like I said, to the last section. I'm going to skip forward about to the themes. Now, of course, the main theme in this book is the environmental issues that No Ice Cap brings up. Or, let me put it this way, the environmental issues which cause the ice pack to be an issue which is now being brought up. I'm loving these clunky sentences that I'm doing today. Anyway, politics surrounding it. So, this is really about the environmental issues that the politics surrounding the environmental issues of the ice pole caps and melting... No, I can't do it. You'll realise why I'm doing these sentences later on. Anyway, later on in the book, we do get a few characters preaching to each other about stuff which seems pretty obvious to me and any modern person who has a slight concern for global warming and is just, you know, generally knowledge about this kind of stuff. You know, because... Let me put this... Sorry, because what am I trying to say here? But, let me put this way. There's stuff that I know already, but because it's set in the North Pole, once all the ice caps having been melted, passively, the people talking about it, when they're actually looking at the last polar bear reserve, they're like, check these out, guys, the last few hundred polar bears, right there. Where? Right there in front of us. Like, there's the last wild ones, and they're not even really wild anymore, because we have to make ice for them to be... You know, it's that kind of... Put it in that setting, suddenly this stuff has a lot more... Not just more power, but sort of, it brings on a different meaning. You really understand what global warming is about. And I could explain, it's about this, and the political stuff is like this, and we could do this stuff, and it's about politically this, and if we do this politically, we could do this, and if we could do this technologically, we could do this. But really, that's what the book is about. I don't want to go too much into it, but that is really what the book is about. It seems to be written for Americans, though. I made a note of this here, because it seems to be, like, it seems to feel the need, the book seems to feel the need to kind of, not hedge its bets, but address the people who think that bets should be being hedged. Because, you know, global warming is happening, and humans are causing it. Now, I don't think many people, you know, don't think so now, but even at the time that this novel is set, when they are literally setting up freezer units to make iceberg for the polar bears not to die on, people still don't seem to be convinced about it. And I think when it gets to that point, nobody is going to say, ugh. And then again, Tobias does mention in his author's notes at the end of the novel, he says, okay, the forecasts that I used for ice melting up in the Arctic were out of date from the time that I started writing it to the time I finished writing it, they were out of date, and now they're even more out of date, and I was probably being too optimistic in writing this book. So even the book is like a meta-comment on the science of, and the forecasting of Arctic ice caps. When I went up to the Arctic on the Prinsen Dam, on this little boat that I sail around the world on quite often, well, not all the way around the world, but I sail around and go to lots of interesting places. On this boat, we went up to the Arctic ice caps, and like I say, about 600 miles from the North Pole. Now, it goes and does that same cruise every year, and it goes up to the polar ice caps, not up to the ice caps, but to the, you know, the pack ice, which is the stuff breaking off into the, off the edge of this stuff, and is sitting there melting as the summer approaches. And it goes up around about the same week every year, and every year it has to travel further and further and further, and they're actually marked out on the map, just with this one ship, how much further north it has to sail on that one week of every year to reach the Arctic pack ice. It is it's serious, really is seriously. And like, I think, yeah, Tobias, I think he is being, his predictions are optimistic, but because they are optimistic, he's addressing a mindset which I don't think would be possible in a world where there are no ice caps over the North Pole at all. Even well, of course, they'll be there in the winter, but in the summer, no summer ice caps over the North Pole. So that's one thing. Oh, there is another theme which came up, apart from, you know, being black and gay and female. What that is, of course, torture. There is this whole, you know, question, of course, the big thing is, if someone had a nuclear bomb and you knew that it was going to go off somewhere, but you wanted to know where, and you had the guy who'd set the bomb, would you torture him to find out why? And I actually really like that this, unlike the cut and dry nature of global warming, or the evidence behind global warming and the outcome of global warming, that isn't this sort of torture in a bad situation like that isn't given the same cut and dry treatment as global warming is gotten. Because, you know, humans are human and sometimes they flinch from doing something hard, but then in other ways, sometimes their morals flinch or they tweak their morals in an extreme circumstance. And it does make for, like I say, a more interesting read. And when you've got a nice character who's also a bit of a badass, you're not quite sure. It's like, in this situation, which way are they going to come down? And there's other people there, and if other people come down in one way, are they going to support them, even for the sake of the friendships and the relationships there and stuff like that? And yeah, although now that I'm suddenly remembering that scene again, or some of those scenes again, I think I've just spotted a massive plot hole, but I didn't notice at the time. Fridge logic, I think it's called, which is very apropos for this novel. Anyway, I've reached the end of my main notes, and as I said, lots of good themes, lots of good characters, lots of good story up until the very, very end bit, lots of good technology, loads of a really great setting. Put aside everything I've said so far, because now what I'm going to do is move on to another part of my brain, which was reviewing this book, and reviewing it in a whole other light, and I must admit, a whole other negative light, because no matter what else I've talked about so far, it sounds like this is going to be like a really high-rated book, but there's one thing that does bring it down, and I've been hinting at it throughout the novel, and that is, of course, the writing. Because, fuck me, Tobias S. Buquel has one of the worst grasps of human, not human, English language, but even human language in a way, but the English language than any published author that I've ever read. And I'm not kidding here. Okay, quick edit here. I must admit that what happened just now is that I went on for a long, 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 long time ranting about how bad the writing was in this novel, and it was a lot of fun. But then I realized that I'd made too many notes, and if I carried on, this review would last for another hour, probably another hour, if I'd have gone through all of my notes. What I've done is I've gone back through and I've edited them down here, and I think this is a good place to jump back in, and hopefully I'll be able to sum up and get through this part. I thought it'd be the last 10 minutes. It was turning into a lot longer than the last 10 minutes of this review. So hopefully I can finish up this review in an hour if I just quickly go through some of these notes after deleting half of them. And I think that probably shows what's going on here. But here we go. So, certain lines from... Where was I up to? I can't even remember where I got up to. Hopefully I'm not repeating myself too much here. But certain lines from Crystal Rain, Tobias S. Buquel's debut novel, stick with me to this day as definitive examples of vague and clumsy sentences and sentence structure. And one thing which I'd like to bring up, which is kind of an inspiration, well, it's very inspirational when people do projects like this, and that is, hey, can you write an entire novel without the letter E in the novel? You'd think the letter E is very common in the English language. It is common in the English language. Someone managed to write an entire novel without the letter E in it. And I was thinking, well, actually, just imagine the idea of writing a novel with no subjects in any sentence. No sentence is allowed to have an object in the sentence, only grammatically subjects and other things like this. And this is really illustrated by one of my favourite sentences, one of my all-time favourite bad sentences of English, which comes from the novel Crystal Rain, the sentence began, movement happened, comma, and this, movement happened. And I'm thinking, well, it's a good job that we have our own imagination here, because after that sentence, you know, well, you didn't help us at all with that sentence. Let me put it that way. So, movement happened. Classic Tobias S. Buquel. So, going into this novel, I thought, hey, check it out. Maybe after writing Crystal Rain, he's written another few novels since then. Maybe his writing has improved. And immediately, three paragraphs in, I realise, wow, this writing has not improved at all as well. And again, not quite sure how much of, you know, did I mention this before I press pause or skip back a bit? You know, how much of the executionist in The Alchemist and the Executionist comes from, you know, how much of my enjoyment or not noticing the bad language in that, say bad language, bad use of language, English language, how much did that come from the reading sort of like making that fade into the background so I can just understand what they're saying. Or maybe that was just better edited. It had better editing. You know, it's probably from a different publisher, worked with a co-author as well on different things. Maybe he just had a higher standard. But I actually had to read the text of this novel. And I say read the text. Sometimes I read sentences twice, three times, sometimes four times. So what I thought I would do is, like I say before, put aside everything that I enjoyed about this fact. Half of my brain, I thought, well, I'll make it into a game. Half of my brain will just read the book, enjoy all the good stuff about it. But then the other half of my brain will go, hey, I will look out for these bad sentences, try and work them out. And once I've worked them out, then I'll pass them across to the other side of my brain who is thinking, hey, I am just reading a good novel over here with a good story and good characters and good setting and all the other stuff that I really like about novels and ideas and themes and technologies, good stuff. You sort out the language, you half of the brain, and then pass it over to me and I'll enjoy the novel. So that's what I did. I split my brain into two. And then, to make it a little bit more of a game, whenever I came across an atrocious sentence, one that's so bad, I would make a note of it. And then when I come over across one which is worse, I'll make a note of that. And I'll only, you know, in a few different categories, a few different areas, I'll only make notes of the worst example of that. And if I find a new worst, that can be the last example. So I'll go back through the notes in reverse and find the worst example of all these bad points. So that's what I did. Unfortunately, as you can tell by me, for the one of the first times ever going back through and editing a novel, editing a review here, if I'm writing a novel, I'll go back through and edit it, unlike Tobias Bacall. When I'm doing a podcast, when I go back through, I never edit it. This is the one time that I actually pressed pause and thought, I got to edit it. It's just for length. Edit it as I go away. So, like I say, make an over bad sentence, do them here. So I made too many notes. I cut off some outs, but I'd still want to go through some stuff to make sure this podcast doesn't last 2 hours. But I still really get across. So it starting off with the vagueness, and it's, you know, it's that vague, passive voice where you're never quite sure. There is no subject in the sentence. There might be an object in the sentence, probably just an object, no sentence. You know, you're never quite sure what is doing the action, which is what makes the sentence passive. And like I say, Tobias S. Bacall, imagine reading a novel, like I say, which is half of the sentences. Anytime action happens, you're not quite sure who is doing the action or what is doing the action. Just stuff has stuff. Stuff has things happen to it, you know. Sometimes a specific person will use something for a specific task, and we'll know exactly who the specific person is, what the task is, and what the object they are using to do that task, but usually, in the vast majority of cases, not. So just a random example that I brought out here from my notes. Someone said, yes, Anton replied, as he waited for the door to be opened. As he waited for the door to be opened. Okay, so he, we're guessing, is Anton, but it might not be. That's one thing you'll learn about reading Tobias S. Bacall books, that if Anton replied as he waited for the door, he could mean someone else. Someone else could be waiting for the door, but let's just pretend it's Anton. He waited for the door to be opened. Who is he waiting to open the door? We know that there's other people around him when he's saying that. We know that there's other stuff going on there, but is he waiting for someone standing next to him for the door to open the door? Or is he waiting for someone inside to open the door? And as we read the sentence, we don't know. As he waited for the door to be opened, or maybe he's waiting for someone looking through a security camera to look at him and go, ah, these guys need the door to be opened. That kind of stuff. And then we get sentences like this, talking about a jet. The jet had been turned around and refueled. And this is right at the beginning of a chapter. This is pretty much, it's like, the jet had been turned around and refueled. And I'm just like, who? Who did that? Who turned the jet round? Who refueled the jet? I don't know. Were there some ground crew? Were there some technicians? We never get to find out. Was it Annika? She flew in. She flew the jet in. She's going to fly home with the jet. No problem at all. What's going to happen? Who did it? Is there, you know, the ground crew? Never understand. I'm guessing there's ground crew. But then, just imagine all of this vagueness. Vagueness, passive sentences, no subjects, all that kind of stuff. And then at one point, or a few points, Tobias tries to use the vagueness of his language to try to be vague. He tries to use it in a way of storytelling. Now, for example, here we go. She's in a fight with a guy. No spoiler. I've already mentioned that before. She could hear the words shit being hissed, as she wasn't sure if they were. She could hear the words shit being hissed, and she wasn't sure if they were in her head or if... I can't believe this. When I read this sentence, I didn't understand what was going on, and I thought it was being clever. Now I realize that I read it wrong, and I read it wrong when I put it in the notes, and I read it wrong the last time I read it when I was recording this podcast, and now I've only just worked out what he's trying to say. He's actually trying to say, she could hear the words shit, 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 but she wasn't quite sure if they were in her head or if she was saying them out loud. That is actually a pretty good sentence. That, I think, is what Tobias is trying. But because he said she could hear the words shit, 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 shit being hissed, I thought the rest of the sentence, and in my head, for some reason, was misreading this, but the way that it made sense to me was that she wasn't quite sure if the words were in her head or if the other guy was saying them. For some reason, I thought the other guy she was fighting. But because he uses the word being hissed, it's difficult to understand I don't understand. I just don't understand who was doing the hissing. I thought he was trying to be clever by putting in the being hissed, by putting in that vague passiveness. Anyway, so I got that wrong. So let me find another example, which I decided to skip, but I will now use. Okay, everywhere she turned, something was being sold. Quite a good sentence, because it's set in like this red light district kind of thing. And she looks around, everywhere she turned, something was being sold. Okay, very vague, everywhere she turned, it's not everywhere she looked, but you know, if it was everywhere she looked, something was being sold, it's like, ah, something, don't want to say what it is. And somebody, we don't want to say who is doing the selling, and we don't really want to be saying who or what they are selling, but something was being sold. It was a continuous action of somebody selling drugs, or their body, or alcohol, or children, or anything like that. We don't know what's being sold. That, you know, nice vagueness about it that you don't want to concentrate on. Who is doing the selling, or who's doing the... Do you understand what I'm saying? I think you do understand what I mean. In a literary... In a novel which has any kind of literary style except shitness, this would stand out and be like, oh, this is interesting. But it's just one ripple of passiveness in a tidal wave. A sea flooding in of passive sentences. And that's just one example of them. But it's like, as an apologist of this novel, you would say, oh, that's a good use. That's a good use of passive sentences. And there can be good uses. So, also, clunky sentences. I read out way too many of these, but I'll just pick out some of the best clunky sentences. Check this one out. As I read this, I'm going to put in better comma placement, or actually more comma placement, because then it makes more sense. A lean but whip muscular older First Nations man with wolf eye contacts and deep creases around his eyes, a look gained from a lifetime lived outside, leaned over the polished mahogany. What do you want? He said. Okay, so first of all, I put commas in there just to make it so easier for you to understand. Second, let's break it down. What we get is a lean but whip muscular older First Nations man with wolf eye contacts. Okay, I don't know where the next comma goes, but I'm guessing it's a lean but whip muscular, comma, older First Nations man. And then you get with wolf eye contacts and deep creases around his eyes, comma, a look gained from a lifetime lived outside. Okay, what was the look that was gained from a lifetime lived outside? Whip muscular? Okay, I get that. Lean? I get that. Maybe this deep creases around the eyes. Okay, a look gained from a lifetime lived outside. But then you get this wolf eye contacts. Wolf eye contact lenses are not gained or acquired or brought about from a life lived outside. You acquire them, you gain them from going to a shop and buying wolf eye contacts. The deep creases, getting old, looking lean, whipped muscular, great. But because if it was like, you know, he had wolf eye contacts, comma, and deep creases around his eyes, a look gained from a lifetime lived outside, you think, oh, the deep creases around his eyes is a look gained from a lifetime lived outside. Anyway, but let's take out all of that and let's just say a man is doing this. Forget all the descriptions here. What we have at the end of this is a sentence like this. A lean man leaned over the polished mahogany. That's what we get. A lean man leaned. A lean man leaned. That's the kind of sentence. When we take away all the shitness and put the commas in the right place and work out actually what the sentence means, we work out that it means a lean man leaned. Now, okay, repeating same words in one sentence like that, the same word meaning different things, or even the same word meaning the same things, I've got an example of that here as well, can be used well, but you've got to strip away the shit language, and then only then can you use clever language if you're not using shit language at every other sentence in the book. Check this out. They're in a boat in rough water. It goes like this. Occasionally, they'd slap a wave roughly enough that a massive blast of ocean spray would slap the cockpit windows. And you think, okay, you slap a wave and it slaps you back. I've been in many small ships at sea and we've slapped into a wave and it slaps the boat back. But we have slapped into a wave and it slaps the boat in return. Here we have, occasionally they'd slap a wave, roughly enough, that a massive blast of the ocean would slap the contact window. Who is they? They are the people in the boat. Are they slapping the wave? No. They're not slapping the wave. The boat is slapping the wave, and the boat is being slapped back. They are not slapping anything. They're being in the thing. They're in the thing which is doing the slapping and returning the slapping back. But they, for some reason, are suddenly the subject. Oh, I'm getting mixed up now. Yeah, the subject of the sentence. Occasionally, they would slap a wave, roughly enough, but they, you know, the spray would. It's bad. Again, clever use of language like this can be done in another book, not in this book. Stop trying to be clever. In fact, I'm being an apologist here. This is my saying, oh, I think he might be being clever here, being a lean man leaned. Slap the wave and it slaps you back. I think it's just bad language, but that's the kind of thing. I can't even pick out the good use of language in this book. Then he gets clunky sentences like this, talking about a bomb in a Middle Eastern country. The terrorists there had gotten a bomb and set... I can't even read it. It makes me cringe. The terrorists there had gotten a bomb and set it off in the capital. I'm like, are you fucking kidding me? Gotten a bomb and set it off in the... Are you going to send us up? No, I've sent us up a bomb. Say, what's the meme? One of the first big internet memes. Send us up a bomb. You know, that kind of stuff. That's the language. That's the level of language. Gotten a bomb. They'd gotten a bomb, had they? How had the terrorists gotten a bomb and set it off in the capital? Check out this one. This is an example. I read this a few times before, and I've practiced this one. So here we go. This is someone talking about people denying global warming later on in the book. This is actually someone talking. Here we go. From the moment the Northwest Passage became passable by actual overseas ship traffic for the first time in human history at the turn of the century, it's been undeniable that the polar region has warmed. Okay, only one comma in that sentence. It fucks my brain up. But I've read it a number of times now, and I think I've got my head around it. So, this is actually someone talking. Now, I've actually been trying to, in the rest of this review, jokingly, come up with clunkier sentences with more passive voice and all this different stuff like that, where you're never actually quite sure what the subject of the sentence is or what's actually been trying to say. I've been trying to make up these sentences. Even me just... I'm trying to do it off the top of my head. But here... If he was trying to craft a more clunky sentence, I couldn't do it. I mean, maybe Tobias Bakel can do it, but that is one of my all-time hits from this book. What he's trying to say is, I had this in my mind from the first time I did it, I worked it out. He means, for the first time in human history, the Northwest Passage opened to shipping, and since then, nobody has been able to deny that the polar region has warmed. I think I left the has warmed in there because we're talking about denying the causes or denying global warming and denying the cause of global warming. So the vague passiveness of, oh, it has warmed. The water has warmed. You're thinking, well, actually, it has been warming because of this, or this has heated the warm water up, or this has heated the region up. We're not doing about that. So actually, that little bit of vagueness there is good because we're talking about denial. We're talking about people denying agency. And here we have someone just getting that idea of denying agency into a sentence and still fucking the sentence up so badly, even though the only thing he uses is the passive voice of half of the book. Half of the book is passive voice. Anyway, so what are we going to go for here? Yeah, and then we get... This is one of my favourite sentences. She still was trying to help him after she had been shot by him. Really? After she had been shot by him? Like... We can make that sentence less passive. I don't think we can make it more passive. How about she still was trying to help him. How about she was still trying to help him even after he'd shot her? That's what the sentence is. That's what the sentence means. That's what he's going for with the sentence. And he can't even, it's like 10 words long. How can you fuck up a sentence which is that short? He managed to do it twice, three times. She still was trying to help him after she had been shot by him. Fucking hell. There's actually a worse clunky sentence, but it contains a spoiler, so I'm going to leave it out this time. Let's skip forward. Oh man, I got up to reach almost an hour already. I'm going to see if I can get this finished off in the next 10 minutes. I really don't want to go as long as I was going to be going last time. Okay. Yeah, talking about giving things agency, which don't make sense. How about this one? She's on the surface. Some people on a ship tried to kill her, but then we get a sentence, she was on the surface of an enemy, the ship that tried to kill her. Not a spoiler, she's looking for a ship, she finds a ship, and she gets on top of it. The ship that tried to kill her. And I was just thinking, all that time, I was like, really was the ship trying to kill her. Again, that sort of messing up with, like, suddenly making the ship be the ominous thing, even though we know that that's not the ominous thing. The ship is just a ship. Fucking who cares about it? She knows the people who are actually, you know, guiding the ship. She's met them already in the book, you know. She's found the people who tried to kill her, and suddenly, after finding the people who really tried to kill her, suddenly the ship has tried to kill her. I'm like, that doesn't work. You can't do that kind of stuff. Then we get this other sentence, which the sentence is, Claude sat for a long moment. Now, you'd think that is a good sentence. Claude sat for a long moment. It means that he's sitting down and then he's going to get up. If he sits for a long moment, what's going to happen? Yes, he's going to get up. But it's not. Actually, Claude is just sitting there listening to someone speak. And this other person speaks in front of him, sitting there for a long moment. And then when Annika, because it's Annika, when Annika stops speaking, Claude doesn't stand up before she starts speaking again. That's what it means. Claude sat for a long moment. Actually, what he really meant to say was that Claude sat in silence for a long moment, or Claude didn't reply for a long moment, or Claude sat for a long moment in staying silent, and that moment stretched too long for Annika to wait for an answer, and so she decided to keep talking. You know, that's what he's trying to say, but just saying Claude sat for a long moment in that context made no sense at all. That Claude sitting for a long moment when he's already been sitting all the way through and he's going to keep sitting until the end of the conversation is not a response. Claude isn't doing anything. He was already sitting. Him not giving a response isn't him sitting. You've got to say that he's not going to respond. Give him something to do except sitting, which he was doing anyway, which is sitting for a long moment is not a response to a comment, unless the comment is get up and start moving. Then if you sit for a long moment, great, it makes sense. But if not, fucking hell, I'm ranting here. Let's get on. Hey, check this out. I definitely have to bring this into this re-recorded last part of the podcast, because this is interesting. Okay, and dropping articles, that's the heading of my little note here. Okay, it goes like this. I'm reading from the book here. You are not investigator. Anton's voice was tight and stressed. She noticed he was dropping articles from his speech, like an or the at random. Comma use in that sentence was bad, but let's go. English was not his first language, and as he got stressed, it was getting harder for him to focus. Great. So he's getting stressed, and he starts dropping ands, all of those. Ignore the fact that the commas were all fucked up, and it was getting harder for him to focus. How about, like, it was getting, and it got harder for him to focus, or it became harder for him. That's a good end to that sentence, but it was getting harder for him to focus. I don't even want to pick out this was just an example of somebody in the novel noticing that somebody else is dropping articles from their speech, and guess what? Tobias Bukel does the same fucking thing throughout him. And I'm thinking, how stressful? How stressful is it to write a novel? If you drop articles from your speech when you're stressed, tell you what, Tobias, if it's that stressful to write a novel, take a break. Just calm down for a bit. Don't miss out. Don't miss out all these articles that you keep missing out on, all these other words which are really important that you just miss out. Is it a stylistic thing? I don't know. Because I know you can use articles. For example, there's a list here. This is the beginning of the sentence. Someone, somewhere, talk about vague, but someone, somewhere, once realized, once, when. Who, where, when did they do it? We don't know. This is how the sentence... I don't even want to pick up on how vague this writing is, but here it goes. Let me get to the real point of this. Someone, somewhere, once realized that the Arctic Circle needed its very own Hong Kong, its very own Singapore. A replication of relatively unfettered laissez-faire mercantilism run amok. A trade-free harbour, low tax haven, a place for the edges of Arctic society to experiment and innovate. So you see that? We get a free trade harbour, a place for the edges, blah, 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 a replication of this, and low tax haven. The whole sentence, three words, and two of the words are hyphenated, so it's a hyphenated word and a word. Low tax haven. That's the sentence. That's the whole sentence. He just drops the article. And I'm just like, it's stressful for you if you're writing this. I mean, if it's stressful enough that you're dropping these articles, guess what? It's even more stressful for me to read sentences with articles missing. That's not stylistically playing around with it. It's just fucking bad English. Okay, here's the, what have I got here? Oh, let's just do this. Here's the title of the next section in my notes. Subjects and objects left over from previous sentences and even paragraphs. So, for example, here's a little. I'll just do two examples of this one rather than like eight or nine that I had here before. Here we go. They've been on a helicopter and they're going to go on another helicopter. I say they because I might as well be as vague as Tobias is throughout the entire novel. They flew out of the island. It's Pleasure Island or something like that. So it's not so much an island, more of a say a rig of some kind. But imagine that. So they flew out. They flew out of the island aboard a Navy helicopter. Unlike the last pilot, this one flew high over the water. Now, it was only in the previous podcast where I worked out what this story, what was going to be the subject in these two sentences. Okay, they flew out of the island aboard a Navy helicopter. Okay, they, I'm thinking they, if it's starting off, they flew out, they are going to be the subject. Okay, they flew out of the island is the object. Aboard a Navy helicopter, that's, I can't remember all the grammar terms here, my brain is melting. And then it goes, unlike the last pilot, this one flew high over the water. And I'm like, okay, the last pilot, so now the pilot is the pilot, the last pilot, this one must be the subject. So this one flew high over the water. And I'm like, did he fly just flapping his wings? No, actually, this one flew the helicopter high over the water. Or this one, unlike the last pilot, this one flew his helicopter high over the water. Unlike the last pilot, this one flew them high over the water. Because then them would be the they in the previous sentence. But actually, it worked out in the last recording of this podcast. Unlike the last pilot, this one flew high over the water. This one is actually talking about the helicopter. They flew out of the Navy, aboard a Navy helicopter. Unlike the last pilot, flew them. Oh, maybe I've got it mixed up. Maybe I had it right the first time and then mistakenly worked out. Okay, fuck that. I'm going to check out a different example. Let me scroll down here. Okay, here we go. Objects and subjects left over from previous sentences. No, the subjects here. So, Rue looked out of the window. People are talking. Skip one sentence. He wasn't listening to them. He wasn't interested in the conversation. But he was very interested in the ships. He kept staring out of the window until they were past the wakes they left behind and banking into a new direction once more. Okay, let's try and parse this one out. But he was very interested in the ships. But he is Rue. Okay, so he is Rue. He kept staring out of the window. Okay, he kept staring out of the window. Until they, fucking hell, who's they? We go back to a previous paragraph, many previous paragraphs, and we work out that they are all of the people in the boat with him, in the room with him. So it's like he kept staring out of the window until they, meaning the ship that he is on. Okay. He kept staring out of the window until they were past the wakes they left behind. Oh, okay, what's this second they? Ah, now we actually realise that they is actually the subject from the previous sentence. So they is like, but he was very interested in the ships. This second they in the same sentence is different from the first they, is actually the object in the object in the previous sentence? I'm going. And then it goes at the end. You go, he kept staring out of the window until they were past the wakes they left behind and banking into a new direction once more. I, even now, looking at this, I don't know who or what was banking into a new direction once more. Was the waves, you know, are the wakes banking into a new direction? They, the ships from the previous engine, banking into a new direction? Is the window banking into a new direction? Is he banking into a new direction? Or is they, meaning the people in the ship, actually meaning the ship that they are sailing on, banking into a new direction once more? This is drives me fucking crazy. I'm reading sentences and they're in my brain, and they're there. Even when they're in my brain, I'm thinking there, how many subjects are in this sentence, and how many objects are in this sentence, and how, when you say they, how many different things does one word they apply to in its different iterations throughout this sentence? Fuck. Okay, here's something. Oh, maybe I'm just gonna stick with, oh, an hour and 10 minutes. Okay, see if I can, what, let me see how many, I've got 1, 2, 3, 4, I've got 4 more sections. I'm going to see if I can get through them in a minute each. Here we go. Vague just what I'm pulling out of the sentence, question mark. This is my my own notes here. This is the heading of this section. Okay, Annika pulled out a plastic card and showed it to the bouncer, a vaguely Eastern European bodybuilder with black light tattoos of wildlife on his forearms that fluoresced with the grow lights that had been jacked into a computer running them through some Fibonacci sequence. Okay, forget even forget all of that sentence, that there was only one comma in that entire sentence, and by the end of it, you actually work out that the subject and the subject is something that Annika pulled out a plastic card and showed it to the bouncer. Vaguely, and you keep going on, and this sentence is just running on and running on and running on. And it's like, me and Jesse were talking a few episodes ago, and we're talking about Mark Twain and how he set up this massively, massively long sentence, and it was an exquisite sentence. It was an amazing, and it was actually talking about somebody making a long sentence. And I actually had to pause when I was listening to the audiobook. I had to pause it like 3 times in the space of one sentence to stop. Not because I didn't know what was going on, but just stop and to laugh because I was laughing too much. I had to stop laughing and then go, okay, I need to listen to the end of this sentence because I don't want to miss any because I'm laughing. Here we have a different thing. I've got to stop 3 times in the sentence just to read back, just to work out where I am in the fucking sentence. And then at the end it goes, running them through some Fibonacci sequence. I'm thinking, okay, through some Fibonacci sequence. Running the lights through some... Does that mean some part of a Fibonacci sequence or some kind of a Fibonacci sequence? Because there's 2 different meanings here and you're being that vague, I don't know what you mean. And then we get another bit a bit later talking about these jets. Here's a sentence. Forget all the clunky stuff in the sentence except for the word some. For a while, the jets had gotten their engines swapped out with engines from an outfit that used some biofuel, but they had failed a few times, forcing emergency landings. Languages? Gotten their engine swapped out? Nah, that's not what I'm saying. That used some biofuel. Okay, what did it use? Did it use some amount of biofuel, or did it use some kind of biofuel? Again, there's the word some has got quite specific meanings, but a number of different meanings. You know, use some amount of biofuel or some kind. That's what we want to know. But he doesn't say, so it uses some biofuel. I thought, oh, it uses some biofuel. Not a lot, but some. Oh, no, it uses some. Too much. Some more. It uses some more, but no, actually, some kind of biofuel. But he was being so vague about what kind of biofuel, or even if biofuel... If he just said, from an outfit that used biofuel, great. Leave out the word some and everything's good. And I know he can use some because he's got like this. He's talking about a jet again. And it goes, it sat under the protection of a wireframe hanger with sheet metal skin painted some shade of future. Let me just start. I'm just going to go for the sentence all the way through. There's no commas in this either. It sat under the protection of a wireframe hanger with sheet metal skin painted some shade of fuchsia. First of all, hanger is spelt wrong. It's hanger with an AR at the end rather than ER. That you're talking about coat hanger rather than hanger for a plane. I'll let that pass. That could just be a mistake. It sat under the protection of a wireframe hanger with sheet metal skin. Does the wireframe hanger have sheet metal skin over its wireframe, or does the plane have sheet metal skin? I don't know. Painted some shade of fuchsia. Is the wireframe hanger painted some shade of fuchsia? Is the jet painted some shade of fuchsia? Or is the sheet metal painted? You know, it's impossible to know. Anyway, some shade of fuchsia. So he knows how to do it. It doesn't say what kind of some shade of fuchsia. It's just like painted fuchsia. Painted some mottled shade, light shade, dark shade, greyish shade of fuchsia. I don't know what you could put in there, but some shade. The word some. I mean, such a simple word. You'd think such a simple word. You could just use the word some in a sentence correctly. No. But then again, another painting example here. They're in a club. Everything blinked or had been painted garish. Painted a garish colour? No, had been painted, repainted garish. Repainted in a garish style? Repainted garishly? Maybe something being repainted garish is just a way... I've never known that way of using the word garish before. I don't know. Garish. Staggering. There's another one. She hit him hard in the temple, staggering him back. Is that how you use the word staggering? It happens a bit later. This is a full sentence, by the way. Then a loud smack staggered him back. Can you be staggered back? Or then a loud smack made him stagger backwards. Then a loud smack made, and he staggered away. You know, that kind of stuff. But staggered him? Can you stagger someone like that? Maybe you can. I don't know. Maybe it's just a way of using this word that I don't know. But in a book full of shit writing, these ways of using words, which might be correct, but I've never seen before in all of the books that I've read, in 153 episodes of this podcast, I've never seen anyone say staggering him back. Hit him hard and staggering him back. Make him stagger back? Anti-staggered back? Yeah. Here's one. Of a bad use of an English word. This is the winner. This is the winner. It's actually quite a nice sentence to begin with, or a little paragraph. It's describing an office, Violet's office. Unlike the greenhouse, Violet's office was plant-free. Wood panels darkened the whole place, and a large computer-free desk dominated the center of it. Sounds good so far. You're actually describing someone as a character by what is not in their office, which is good. It's plant-free, and there's a computer-free desk in the middle of it. Good stuff. You know what kind of person she is when she does business. No plants, even though she has a greenhouse. And no computer. Good stuff. She's an action kind of woman. No computer. Then you get this sentence, which is the worst sentence. Small leather couches were scattered around, carefully positioned in front of the desk and facing it. Forget about carefully positioned in front of the desk and facing it. Just, let's just go to get these two things that these couches are at the same time being had done to them or in a continuous state of being in this thing. It's weird. Small leather couches were scattered around. I mean, but then carefully positioned. So you've got couches which are scattered around, carefully positioned. It's a comma in between. The couches are scattered and carefully positioned. How can that make sense? That doesn't make sense in any way. Scattered means the opposite of carefully positioned. It should say small leather couches were arrayed around the desk, carefully positioned in front of it, or carefully positioned friendly. Smaller the couches were settled, were placed, were laid out. Maybe the small leather couches had been arranged in front of the desk facing it. Scattered. Actually, let me just, I can do this. I'm running into territory that I didn't do, but I'm getting there quicker. Let's just check on my little thesaurus here in this thing. Thesaurus, scattered. Throw, strewn, toss, fling, sprinkle, spread, distribute, sow, broadcast, disseminate, bestrew. I like the word bestrew. Mean, all of those mean the opposite of carefully positioned. That's definition one. Two, scattered could also mean disperse, break up, disband, separate, move, go in different directions, go separate ways, dissipate, dissolve, drive, send, put to flight, chase, disassemble. That's what scattered means. Almost every single one of them in the throwing and the dispersion kind of definition of scattered is the opposite of carefully positioned. It's the opposite. He used two words to describe the same thing, which are mutually exclusive, and it makes my brain explode because it's so good. The sentence before that was so good. It was a character thing. He was describing by the lack of what was in the office about what this person was like. Again, I'm being passive here as well, but it was good. I could get a hold of what this character was, and immediately he follows up by chairs scattered around and carefully positioned, all facing the same way. I'm like, fuck, how am I meant to understand this character when she scatters chairs in a carefully positioned way, in a way that can't be done? Mutually exclusively language about the same object. Subject, sorry. I might as well use... Anyway. So, final point here. Woohoo! I'm getting through it a bit quicker. Although, still, I'm probably going to finish up in an hour and 20 minutes of this one. There are some... It goes, this is my thingy down. It might be down to it being an ARC, an advanced reader copy. So, some of these small errors... There are some small errors which could be picked up. For example, here's one. The bike's key... A motorbike, this is. The bike's key was actually just an RFID chip in a decorative logo casing that didn't need inserted into the bike. Didn't need inserted into the bike. I think he probably means that didn't need to be inserted into the bike. Or, if we want to make it more vague, didn't need inserting into the bike. Could be. And then you get like something like this. Rue is on a ship. He's trying to get off the ship. And Rue ran and back... leapt into the dinghy. And so it should be, and Rue ran back and leapt into the dinghy. Oh, actually, no, looking at it now, maybe this is an idea of a good sentence, a correct sentence by Tobias Espichel, because actually it could be backleapt if you backleap into something. Does that work? Rue ran and backleapt into the dinghy? Could that be hyphenated? Or maybe Rue ran and, I would say, Rue ran and leapt back into the dinghy, or Rue ran and leapt backwards into the dinghy. All of these different sentences make more sense to me than and Rue ran and backleapt into the dinghy, which makes me think he's made a mistake, but then makes me think, actually, no, he hasn't made a mistake. He's just a fucking atrocious writer. So, lots of these times, lots of different mistakes and stuff like that going on in this novel. Lots of different, just bad, which obviously are not mistakes, but just mistaken uses of English language. Which brings me back to this blog post that I wrote about before and posted on my blog. People keep asking me, hey, you should review movies that you see. If you see a science fiction movie, you should review it here on the podcast. And I say no, because I never find out I'll have enough to do it. But there is enough to write a short blog post and a short review of some movies. And recently I watched these fan edits of the Star Wars movies, which were pretty good, really good fun. There was one which was called The Phantom Edit, where someone has gone through, I think it was the DVD release of The Phantom Menace, and cut out a lot of Jar Jar Binks and a lot of rubbish chase sequences and stupid monsters and lots of Anakin action and things like that. Lots of good, lots of bad stuff had taken out. And actually, kind of, I'm not sure if they swapped some stuff around, but they left a movie which was way, way better than the first one. But the other one, which I think is more interesting as a creative project, was Star Wars A New Hope Revisited, where someone has gone through the original Star Wars, episode number 4, and not so much like edited any for content, but just gone through and fixed all the tiny little continuity mistakes and the little rough edges around the seams and things like that. Again, there's this massive long list. If you just look at my blog post, you can find it. I mean, I'm sure the blog post will be posted in a bit, but you'll be able to find it. And it is an interesting way of doing this. Doing this, just going through it. Like, for example, one of the examples that you read there is, he goes, okay, well, in the bar, in the cantina, Obi-Wan Kenobi cuts this guy's hand off, and when he cuts off the hand, it's the left hand, and when it lands on the floor, it's the right hand, or vice versa. And he says, well, we fixed that. Now it's the right, he chops off the right hand, and the right hand lands on the floor. Good stuff. Loads and loads of continuity things, like, and also things where, you know, where a rebel person would fall over and die, but they hadn't been hit by a bolt. He put a bolt in there, so it made them look like they fell over, and all these different kind of stuff. And I'm just thinking, maybe we need a fan edit of this book, because I give this book 3.5 stars as it is now. But just imagine if it hadn't been written by someone who has no control over the English language at all. I've got editing in mind at the moment, because I've just finished off like a first draft of a novel, a third novel in the series. And I've been going back through and just checking things. You know, I'm not doing any major changes. It's just before I give it to people, I just want to make sure that each of the sentences is under control. Each of the sentences, when you read it, you understand what is going on or what bit of information is meant to be being conveyed by the sentence that is on the page. You know, for me as a writer, that is like a basic function of a sentence, that it puts across a small amount of information, instills some kind of feeling in the person by the style of the sentence. You know, you've got the content of the sentence, the style of the sentence, and, you know, the order of the sentence makes the whole thing make sense. And I'm just thinking, well, when I'm reading this book, I'm like, I could probably go through this book in under, I mean, it took me, what, 6 or 7 hours to read? Probably in around about 10 hours. I could go through this novel again, get all of these sentences, make them make sense, give the sentences without any sense, without any subject, a subject, correct some of the repeated use of words. You know, if something is a hanger, make sure it's spelled H-A-N-G-A-R, just wanted to make sure I got that right, you know, and all that kind of stuff. And I'd leave some of the passive sentences in. Everywhere she looked, not everywhere she turned, but everywhere she looked, someone was selling something. I can't remember what the sentence was, but it was a really good passive sentence, because it had plot significance, and it had descriptive scene-setting significance, that she was seeing something and not wanting to concentrate on it, so making it vague is good. Leave some of that in. I don't want to change the tone of the novel, or the characters, or the action, or the setting, or even any of the language, you know, actually the tone of the language. Or I say, like, the choice of words. Fuchsia can be a good one, you know. Talking about the wolf eye contact lenses is good. You know, all the actual descriptions can make sense, but just get the action to actually be people doing actions rather than things happening around other things while other things somewhere once did this. I'm like, no, fuck it. Said experts or politicians once agreed, or trade agreements once thought this would be a good idea. Tell us who is doing stuff, to who, at what point. They, in one sentence, shouldn't refer to three different things or two different things, some of them inanimate objects or ships, and other people, the other they is a group of humans, you know. It's that kind of thing. Just clear that up. I reckon this book could be like a 4-star novel easily. Easily a 4-star novel. There's so much good stuff in there, you know, but it's just, someone just edit the fucking novel.
And it could be a classic. And it's not. It's never going to hold up. People are going to read this. They're going to get it three paragraphs in and just go, oh, fuck. They're going to get an hour and 23 minutes into this podcast and go, Luke's still talking about the bad spelling. It's fucking that bad. It's not my fault. Tobias S. Buchel put me up to this. He said, hey, read this book in so many ways. It's going to be awesome. And in the way that's just going to, you're going to actually have to split your brain into two to enjoy this novel. One part is going to have to disassemble the language and assemble it in a way which the other side of the brain can make sense of. And then you'll enjoy the book. And the other half did enjoy the book. And to be honest, the previous half, the first half, which was actually doing the reading and the sentence restructuring and working out, I've actually had a lot of fun ranting about this. I managed to finish up in under an hour and a half, probably one of my longest episodes ever. But I tell you something, if I hadn't have taken out some of these notes, this would have easily have gone an hour, 2 hours. So I'm glad I did this. So good book, good, everything good about it, except unfortunately for the stuff that you've got to read on the page. If you enjoyed this review, please email me, luke@juggler.net. That's the best way to get in contact with me. If you want to read my blog, I'm putting new stuff up there all the time. You can subscribe to that at lukeburge.com/blog. You can follow me on Twitter. I'm @lukeburge on there. Even become my friend on Facebook if you want to follow along. Not so much with my reading and other things like that, but juggling and traveling and all that kind of stuff goes there. And what else? Oh, yes, of course, goodreads.com. I didn't bother opening the page because I'm not online at the moment. And because this is an advanced reader copy, I'm sure that none of the listeners to this podcast have got a copy yet to read and review. So I can't really see what you guys think about this novel. But really, don't let the bad language put you off. You've just got to separate it out in your brain. That's all I can say. 3.5 stars. Good novel. That's it for now. Oh, there was one final thing. I was gonna read out the clunkiest sentence that I... This was the last, I think, the last clunky sentence. So this must have been one of the clunkiest sentences in the whole novel. It is a bit of a spoiler, though, so turn off now. Thanks a lot, and I'll catch you later. Okay, here we go. Clunky sentence. She could see that there were still clumps of air in between 5 different masses of silvered clouds as the spheres were still coagulating over whatever position Gaia was commanding them to slowly move into. One sentence, no commas. Make what you can out of that. I'm going to read that again a few more times in my head, but I won't put you through it. I'm just going to press stop. Catch you later.